circa.
On our head, thank you, Chair. I hope I won't ask the question that was already asked. Chair, if the, I don't know whether the department will be able to explain this, Chairperson. We see that the offset project, I saw there that it skips. It's not only that. Now I see the grass cutting and as well as the insulation of the roofs. What prevalent air pollutants needed to be addressed in those particular areas so that it helps us as the portfolio as well to be on the same page? Because for me, if you say grass cutting, cutting grass is an offset project, I don't know what's the background of this. Unless if we are informed as the portfolio, this was the pollutant that was prevalent in that area. So in order to be able to reduce that pollutant, we said these are the issues that they needed to address. I know that maybe the burning of grass will be an issue, but at least if you are informed, like the sealing of roofs, is that reducing the pollutant? Because as far as where I'm sitting, if you just reduce the heat, there will be no longer that cold. If it's hot outside, I mean, if it's cold outside. So, but if we are being informed, this is what we are trying to address, or this is what the department identified as a prevalent pollutant, and then we went to the industry and said, you need to reduce, so that we are able to play our oversight. Otherwise, if you tell us about the skips, and there are no tipper trucks, it doesn't ring a bell to me. You are cutting the grass, you are taking over the responsibility of the municipality. The municipality is sitting don't know what to do now because you are taking the responsibility of the municipality. Unless you are informed, these were the prevalent pollutants. This is how we are trying to reduce, or that is how we are trying to do the offset project in order to reduce that prevalent pollutant. I think, hope I'm clear, Chair. I'm coming across quite clearly to the other side. Thank you.
Okay. Honorable Stinka.
Thank you, Jay. I wanted to ask this earlier with ESCOM as well, but I'm gonna try and ask. I don't know if I'm gonna sound stupid. Both ESCOM and Sasol in their presentations basically show that they are complying. They're below the exceedances or whatever you call it. So, but when I came in, now Dr. Tuli might need to tell me if I'm wrong. When I came in now, you were saying that we don't breathe once a year, we breathe continually, meaning that there's hourly, weekly, monthly, annually, that you have to comply. What I don't understand is that what I get from what you said is that they're not complying, but the presentations are saying that they're all complying. So where am I missing what?
Okay. Honorable McClure.
Chair, firstly, it's just something that does not relate, Chair, to the presentation. Just looking at the delegation of Sasol in comparison with that of ESCOM in this house, I think there still a need for transformation at that level, be it on gender or any other consideration that you will want to have, so that it should not like we going away without having recognized that fact. So, yeah, I think it's worth mentioning, Chair, that something must be done.
Transformation.
Yes, it was not presented.
Well, there's one female, one male.
I think they can do better, Chair.
Okay.
Surely they can do better.
Yeah. Yeah, but okay, you can answer that question. Or you're
no,
still
it will be answered. Yeah, it needs to be answered.
I thought you are done. Sorry.
No, you know, on the offset, I'm just trying to. Is there going to be a deadline when this program is going to end? Or it will just roll as long as there are challenges and so on? What will inform its ending or its conclusion and so on? Or there has not been any thinking in that regard?
Okay.
Transformation required in SASL. What I certainly will do is I will take that point back to the senior leadership and make sure that that is heard. I'm going to ask Lauren to talk a little bit to add some more colour to the offsetting program, and perhaps she can address. So there's been quite an extensive process where we have identified, together with the municipality, the different pollutants that we're responding to in each of the areas around our facilities. So it was based on that. It was also done in consultation with the community. But I'll ask Lauren just to add some colour to that. And then I'm going to ask Stefan to talk to the proposal that we made. So I would like to say that the proposal that we made is not about changing the legislation. It was really to maybe the effect of it might have been, you know, a lower level, but it's really to accommodate our facility in Secunda. So what we say is that we get really close to meeting the standards, but we're unable to meet the index. We're unable to just get there. We're very close but unable to get there. So we needed to find a way in which that could be accommodated without shutting the plant down. I think we, you know, we it's compulsory for some of the unintended consequences of shutting down facilities like Secunda. So our proposal was really to use an existing mechanism that we believe allows us the flexibility, but it also allows the department the opportunity to ensure that we were making regular improvements in relation to ECHO 2. So I'll just hand over to Lauren and then I'll ask Stefan to add as well.
Thanks, Ronel. Good afternoon, everybody. In terms of the offsets and what how we derived what projects to target, firstly, when we got a postponement decision in 2015, there was a requirement in there to implement offset plans in both the Secunda and Sasselburg regions of our plants to address ambient particulate matter as well as sulfur dioxide. So that was the requirement. In terms of then developing the plan, we looked to four sources, some of which my colleague Ronel has already alluded to. First and foremost, we looked at the air quality management plans for the Vaal Triangle area as well as the Highveld priority area to assess what was recognized therein as some of the main non-industrial sources of pollution. Secondly, we also engaged with our local licensing authorities, who are obviously very hands-on and knowledgeable about what the challenges in their areas are. Thirdly, we spoke to our communities, so we went through an extensive public participation process with meetings that were attended by over 1,000 community members in our Sasselburg and Secunda regions combined. And through that three-step process, we came up with the proposed projects to address ambient particulate matter as well as sulfur dioxide. In parallel with that, we began a detailed, what we call a baseline campaign, which involved 12 different elements of monitoring, some of which was surveys, speaking to people, some of which was ambient monitoring, and a piece of work which we called source apportionment, which is to physically measure, to take samples of particulate matter from the air and analyze those to see what different, what are the sources that that particulate matter comes from. And so that process, we've completed our winter monitoring, our winter measurements of the source apportionment. We are waiting for the summer results, but we can confirm that in both areas, we did see the signals from the non-industrial sources that we are targeting. So in the Zambela region, for example, there was definitely a signal of waste burning. And I'll come to the questions around waste burning and why are we targeting forest fires and waste. But so we saw a waste burning signal in our winter results. I stress we're waiting for the summer results in Zambela. And in the Secunda region, we saw domestic fuel burning, i.e. people burning solid fuels, typically coal, but also wood in winter to heat their homes. If I may just then briefly talk about why are you cutting grass? It's because of fault fire management. It's to try and limit the amount of particulates that go into the air. And when, I think we've all seen fault fires, and they are short in duration, but they can be very high in concentration. So we are trying to address particulate matter through that project. In the Zambela area, what we've also found is when fault is burnt, because a lot of waste isn't collected, the fault, there's waste in the fault and waste is also burning. So it's addressing both challenges through those both projects. Thanks, Ronal.
Chair, maybe to come back to the first question in terms of the changes to the regulatory framework that was proposed, and maybe just to give that context. In the conversation we had with the DEA, the question that we tried to address is, if we look at our emissions from a point source perspective, in other words, how do we comply with the minimum emission standards or the MES? And we do get to a situation where, in terms of the challenges that our facility and the coal we are burning presents us, what else is there that we can propose, as opposed to just a notion of rolling postponements and saying basically there's nothing we can do? So our understanding is that the Act today already makes provision for concurrent measures in the form of either the MES and or pollution prevention plans to be utilized in achieving ambient air quality targets. For example, in the case of CO2, we've just recently submitted a draft PPP or pollution prevention plan, and this was a mechanism that we thought, and again using this picture as an example, that you tie industry's emissions to non-industrial sources in an objective to try and improve the ambient air quality itself. So the mechanism that was proposed was actually an existing mechanism within the Act. It is not a new mechanism. It would be supplementary to what MES is trying to do.
Chief, I could just add one final point. However, we should say that in conversation with the DEA, it became quite clear that the proposal that we had suggested might not be possible to implement. So I just wanted to say that there's no conflict between ourselves and the DEA. It was really through a point of conversation that we raised it as one possible mechanism. But it was clear that, you know, through conversation it wasn't possible. The department was not comfortable with it at all.
Okay, so I think that, I hope that answers the question. It was not that we said not change the law. Actually utilize what was in the law. And then maybe just to ask the member's question on, so the definition of compliance, so are we now complying, are we not complying? I think some of the confusion again comes in by using this picture as an example. The graph that we showed, for example, today is what comes out our stack and is being governed by our minimum emission specifications. And there's two limits. We've got the 2020 of existing plant standards and we've got new plant standards. And so again, speaking from a current day perspective, yes, we are compliant in terms of what exits the stack. Talking from new plant standards perspective, in future, we will not be able to get to new plant standards. From that perspective, at that given moment in time, if nothing changes, we will possibly be deemed non-compliant. Some of the slides that were shown by ESCOM today actually is not what comes out the point sources of their stacks, but is what's in the ambient is being measured. So there, the National Air Quality Act has got limits as well, and that's what they were referencing as well. Now, and that is a function of multiple sources, and I think the point that ESCOM was trying to make is if you measure there, yes, on whether it's annual averages, month averages, day averages, there's a different set of measures there. But I think it is important to actually tie this together to say that all of these initiatives, ultimately, we presume the Act's intention is to ensure that from an ambient air quality perspective, that everybody has the opportunity to breathe that safe and healthy air.
Okay, follow up.
Yes, any contemplation of when the offsets program will come to an end? What will, is it going to be the impact? What is it? Or there's no thinking as yet in that direction?
In terms of when it will end or when it will end, I'm not sure.
Yeah, so it is, so the current plan goes up to 2020. And the intention also is that part of the program is to make sure that the programs that we initiate are subsequently taken over by the local authorities. In fact, on all of the programs, we're working very closely with the local authorities so that by 2020 they would be able to take all of it over.
Thank you, Chair. Last question.
That's a follow-up, Chairperson, from the department. The offsets by Sasol, are they improving the air quality, the ambient air quality in those areas? That would be my question to the department.
Okay. To whom is the question directed? Department. Yes, Tuli.
Thank you, Chair. I don't think I heard the question.
Okay. My question is, the offset projects that were implemented by Sasol, are they improving the air quality, ambient air quality in those areas that you identify? I mean, the pollutant that you identify, is there any improvement? That would be my question. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, there are improvements at the local level when you look at the monitoring that is being done there. But, Chair, while can I just respond to the other one of the monitoring? So, in industry, there's two types of monitoring. There's a monitoring for compliance, which is on the stack itself, whether it is meeting the requirements of the law. And then there's ambient monitoring that is done, which the department also does. And the other spheres of government that we have presented. Now, the ambient monitoring is outside there. It measures everything. The stack monitoring is for this particular plant. But the other thing is all the monitoring stations that are outside have objectives. So, for example, there will be a monitoring station in a township and a monitoring station that is sitting in the receiving environment or what we call a fence line or downwind of a particular plant. So what you will see in terms of the trends is different. That's why then some of the discrepancies come. Our stations are measuring exceedances, and that is what we work with. A station that is a research station, for instance, sitting in a almost background location where there's no local source of pollution, would then show that there is no problem when you look at those results. And that's where some of the problems start. Perhaps, Chair, as a last one for me, when it comes to the issue of the Section 29 of the Pollution Prevention Plan, I was just telling Director Isham here, this is taking us back to the legal review that Sasol had against the department, where the argument was manage ambient air, not individual sources. And there's nowhere in the world where you manage air pollution like that. You manage all sources of air pollution, and then you measure in the ambient air the results of those different strategies. But because we do not, at this point, regulate SO2 using the pollution prevention plan, it is a change in regulation if you say, let's do it this way. So just to provide that clarity. But I think there's no point laboring this issue now because there's this expert panel that is going to be established. Just to clarify, Chair, why the presentation says it is proposing a regulatory change, because that is not how SO2 is regulated currently.
Come again.
I missed the last part.
As I said,
the proposal about regulatory change.
Because what NSFL is saying, use Section 29 of the Act, which is a pollution prevention plan, to address the issue of SO2. It's a regulatory change that they are proposing. Because at the moment, SO2 is not managed using that section. So it is a change. And it will affect far more industries than the industries we have in the room today. Because we're a fossil-based economy. A lot of industries emit SO2. And it's a big change, actually, in the regime. And I don't see how that is taking us to the objectives of ambient air quality that we have set in this fund. Thanks.
Okay, so it's the same argument you were making earlier, basically. Okay, you are adding to the earlier argument. So you don't want to accept that it's the same argument you're making. You are just motivating the argument about changing the legislative regime. DG, I saw you raising your hand.
Well, Chair, maybe it's not necessary. I wanted to say that that section, we're using it to manage emissions overall, not necessarily SO2. And the way it was crafted at the time, it was basically trying to help us deal with the stopgap measure before we have the air quality, the climate change legislation. So the outcome in terms of what the regulator was envisaging is different from what is being proposed by SASO. It's an instrument that is there, so the question is whether it can be further explored, and I think maybe other experts must look at it, but it was never really intended for the management of sulfur dioxide, per se.
Yeah. No, I think the reason why I like this proposal about the panel is, in fact, it's carrying forward what we said needs to be done around SO2, to look at the concerns raised and what intervention is required. Because the last time we met at the workshop, it was almost like it's a problem, nobody knows how is it going to be attended to. And we said, no. Go look at this thing, propose ways of dealing with this problem, mitigating it or dealing with the problem so that at the end of the day there must be compliance with the law. So I like the fact that the panel of experts will then sit and look comprehensively at this and then give us proposals or give the department proposals on how to resolve this thing. Because clearly the argument that there is no way we can resolve the SO2 problem is not acceptable. So, and it's advanced by both ESCOM and SASOL. So I guess it's well timed, this proposal. So let's look at that and let's see what can be done. And of course, SASOL might be proposing this solution about looking or using that section out of, I don't know, is it out of desperation or is it properly researched? But from what the argument is, obviously you can't use that section because you're going to open up a loophole for other industries as well. So I guess it's work in progress. For now, what I think needs to be monitored by the department is this offset program. So that I think is something that the department must get closer to ESCOM and to SASOL to make sure that these offset programs are working
and the communities are also happy with the offset programs. So for now, that's what we have. Thank you very much, Sasson, for coming here. You are always available when we want you to come to Parliament. Yourself and ESCOM, we would like to thank you very much. I'm sure by now you have almost made an assessment of where the committee is coming from in terms of this minimum emission standard issue. We want us to move to a point where there is full compliance, maximum compliance. So this engagement must also help you when you go back to make proposal to your principals on how quick can we move. Money is always an issue, because I see every time Sasson makes a presentation, you start from the investments you are making, which is good, because you have to make those investments in the country, because, you know, for a lot of reasons that we don't have time now to discuss. But thank you very much. Let's have the NGOs. Well, I must say that initially, let me not talk about initially. We don't have enough time, and I think we took a lot of time this morning when we were discussing the Marron Islands and the drama there. we should have dealt with that a bit after, because I picked up a lot of people who were so amused by what has happened there. But we don't have enough time. I don't know how many presentations we have, how long is it going to take. Can we do everything in 30 minutes? Not possible.
Hi, Chair. We'll try. There are four presentations.
Four.
Prof. Kenkos and I are the longest. We'll be as quick as we can. May I get started in that case?
Well, I must apologize. Chileka did not alert me. I thought we were only dealing with ESCOM, Sasson, and the department. I was not alerted, but it's fine. We could have been very strict on time. But anyway, it's okay. Let's proceed.
Thanks, Chair. Good afternoon, Honourable Chair and members. I think this committee knows by now who the Centre for Environmental Rights are, and that we work with partners in the Life After Coal campaign with those aims that are displayed on the screen. So the NGOs, I'll just give you a quick quick overview of the presentations we'll be making and some updates. Prof. Cairncross is best placed to make technical input into the questions of MES compliance and technology options for abatement of SO2 emissions. This talk about the panel to investigate the complexities, we have some concerns. We don't know, you know, who's going to be on it, how long its work will take, whether the purpose is not simply to further delay compliance, because in reality we suspect no work is going to be done while the panel is investigating the options, but we'll talk about that. And then after Prof. Cairncross, Thomas Mguni and Samson Mukwena, who live in the Highveld and Vaal Triangle priority areas respectively, are going to tell us what's happening on the ground. There's no dispute that air pollution in the priority areas is above safe levels. So there's some debate about the number of exceedances of the national ambient air quality standards, but there are certainly multiple exceedances. And this is despite the fact that our South African standards are weak and significantly more lax than the 2005 World Health Organization guidelines. Prof. Cairncross will give some examples of this. The same goes for our minimum emission standards, which are also substantially less stringent than elsewhere in the world, including other developing countries. And multinational companies like Sasol do comply with stricter standards in other jurisdictions. We also don't have relevant standards for all of the harmful pollutants. We also, there's also no dispute that industrial emissions, including coal-fired power generation, are by far the largest sources of air pollution in the priority areas and in South Africa, and that they're devastating health impacts and violations of constitutional rights that result from these high levels of pollution, and that these health impacts have significant economic impacts. Where pollution isn't addressed, the costs are then externalized, so we pay for this rather than the industry who are responsible for the pollution. The Lancet Commission on Pollution and Health is an initiative of the Lancet, which, as I'm sure you know, is the world's most respected health journal, the Global Alliance on Health and Pollution, and the Icahn School of Medicine. It comprises many of the world's most influential leaders, researchers, and practitioners in the fields of pollution management, environmental health, sustainable development, and what it aims to do is to reduce air, soil, and water pollution by communicating the extraordinary health and economic costs, giving solutions, and really dispelling the myths that pollution is inevitable. What the Commission found, it conducted its work over 2 years, was that in 2015, pollution was responsible for about 9 million premature deaths. That's 16% of all deaths worldwide and 268 million disability-adjusted life years. That is 3 times as many deaths caused by AIDS, TB, and malaria combined, and 15 times more than the number resulting from all wars and other forms of violence. 92% of pollution-related disease is in low- and middle-income countries, and in the hardest-hit countries, pollution-related disease is responsible for more than one death in four. So although household air and water pollution are decreasing, as well as deaths from pneumonia and diarrhea, for instance, ambient air, chemical, and soil pollution are all on the rise, and non-communicable diseases caused by these forms of pollution are increasing too. When we look at air pollution in particular, it was responsible in 2015 for 6.4 million deaths. That's 2.8 from household air pollution and 4.2 million from ambient air pollution. Of course, pollution-related disease causes massive economic loss, and the report confirms that pollution and pollution-related disease are not the unavoidable consequences of economic development. So this notion that low- and middle-income countries have to pass through some phase of pollution and disease as they grow, the Commission says is obsolete and unsubstantiated. Proven cost-effective pollution control strategies are actually available today to countries at every income level, which are based on law, policy, and technology, and the most effective of these eliminate pollution at source. So pollution is no longer to be viewed as an isolated environmental issue. It's a transcendent problem affecting the health and well-being of entire societies. Leaders of government at all levels have to elevate pollution to a high priority within their agendas, integrate pollution control into development planning, actively engage in pollution prevention and prioritization, and link pollution prevention with commitments to advance sustainable development goals, to slow the pace of climate change, and to control non-communicable diseases. So the Lancet Commission found that pollution control and pollution-related disease prevention require a concerted effort to make pollution prevention a high priority, to set firm targets for reduction of disease, and to establish data systems to monitor pollution and disease, and to end the externalization of pollution by enforcing this idea that the polluter has to pay. In South Africa, as you know, there are multiple reports on health impacts, including ones that Eskom itself has commissioned. The most recent is Dr. Mike Holland's 2017 report, which found that air pollution from Eskom's coal-fired power stations kills more than 2,200 South Africans every year, causing thousands of cases of bronchitis and asthma in adults and children annually, even only looking at PM2.5 exposure. This, he found, costs our country more than 30 billion rand annually through premature deaths, hospital admissions, and lost working days. Given the seriousness and importance of these findings and the urgency to take meaningful action to reduce pollution, we invited members of various portfolio committees to attend a presentation by Dr. Holland of this report in Parliament in September 2017, and we're pleased that several members of the Health Committee attended as the representative of this committee. Broken promises. These health impacts and many other problems with the priority areas, with a focus on the high-fault priority area, were highlighted in this report, which was launched on 2 October 2017, which, as you'll remember, makes a number of key recommendations for authorities to implement
to demonstrate that improving air quality is actually a priority for government. These, we say, are the minimum steps that must be taken by the state to meet its constitutional obligations and to meet the obligations under the Air Quality Act. So there were calls for the HPA facilities to comply with the minimum emission standards, with the National Air Quality Officer to review those postponements that were already granted, for no more MES postponements to be permitted, and for AEL licensing authorities to suspend the issuing of all new AELs in the HPA until there's consistent compliance with the National Ambient Air Quality Standards. 4 months later, we don't yet have a response from the Department of Environmental Affairs. They initially promised a response by the 11th of October, and then on the 12th of December promised a comprehensive response by the 30th of January. But on the 2nd of February, the DEA asked for a further 3 weeks to respond. We hope that this long-awaited response is going to be detailed with a clear plan of action and timeframe. We heard a bit today about an additional MES postponements from Eskom, the first of which that we've already received the background information document for is for Tatuka for the existing plant's particulate matter standard. So although it was already granted a postponement for almost 5 years, Eskom wants another 5 year postponement of the PM 2015 MES. So instead of complying with 100 micrograms per normal cubic meter by the 15th of April 2015, it now seeks to do so only by 2025. This is in circumstances where its current licensed emission limit is already very lenient. That's 3.5 times the 2015 MES, and from 2019 it's going to be double the MES. So really, it's clear that Eskom hasn't taken enough steps in the interim to make sure that it's going to comply with its postponed limits. For the record, as we all know, the MES was set in a 5 year process in March 2010 already, so this is not a surprise that this compliance is required. We're still awaiting monthly emission reports for Tatuka and several other stations, which were granted to us following an appeal in terms of the Promotion of Access to Information Act. In fact, and as we also heard today, we're told that Eskom is shortly going to be starting a program to apply for postponement for most of their coal-fired power stations for a variety of pollutant types. We've asked for a schedule as to when to expect which. We haven't received this yet. We hear Eskom saying today that this is still under review. On Medupi, the enormous cost and time overruns at Medupi and Kasile have received quite a lot of attention in the press. And then for SO2 in particular, Eskom only intends to meet the 2020 MES for Kusile, which has FGD integrated into its design, and for Medupi, which will eventually have FGD retrofitted onto each unit. We hear today that they will be investigating a pilot plant for circulating fluidized bed for Kendall, which, if successful, would only start construction in the 2030s. I say eventually in relation to the Medupi retrofit, because as things stand, the environmental impact assessment for Eskom to get its authorization to retrofit FGD has been stalled for years. The draft environmental impact report is still awaited for comment. What this means is that the first unit's retrofit is still some way from commencement. You'll remember in terms of their loan agreement with the World Bank, Eskom must retrofit FGD within 6 years of each of Medupi's 6 units being commissioned. So since 2014, that's 4 years now, given the delays in Eskom's overall construction program, we've been arguing that FGD should be integrated into the design and construction of as many units as possible, as it is for Kusile. Eskom's refused to do this for reasons that aren't clear to us. The massive delays in its construction program clearly provide this opportunity for Eskom to integrate FGD into the last 3 units of Medupi. There is also sufficient water to do so, and this result should result in some cost savings compared with retrofitting FGD. Eskom has said that wet FGD is the most effective means to abate SO2. A specialist study showed that a flue gas cooler would reduce water consumption by up to 30% and would be cost neutral, but Eskom has yet to confirm that this cooler will be implemented, finally indicating at the end of 2016 that this would be included in the next report as a design alternative. So just to show this table from this specialist study, which shows the costs of wet FGD with and without the cooler and of dry FGD. You can see the water cost differences there in option 1 and 2, and the total costs are almost exactly equivalent. So we see no reason for the cooler not to be an obvious inclusion. You will also remember that Eskom reapplied for postponement of the SO2 2015 standards for Medupi and Matimba, although its previous application was rejected already in 2015. To date, the DEA hasn't indicated the outcome of that second application, which we said should have been rejected as being legally impermissible. A joint African Development Bank and World Bank mission in early 2017 expressed concern that Medupi would not be able to comply with the existing plant MES for SO2. They again suggested that Eskom seriously consider an interim strategy to control SO2 before FGD is implemented. They talk about their previous suggestion to adopt a direct furnace limestone injection program, which they say has been tested in the USA and in Europe and shown to reduce SO2 emissions by up to 50%. A field testing program with this technology on Unit 6 or 5 to obtain technical confidence had been suggested earlier, and the mission reiterated this for Eskom's serious consideration. Eskom has indicated to us that it has considered this option, but provided no information as to why it has not implemented it. It told us to direct further inquiries regarding the status of follow-up actions via the PIA process. So we want to reiterate that Eskom is contractually committed in terms of its loan agreement to install Medupi in its FGD, in its Medupi plant. The retrofitting of FGD, rather than integrating it into the design and construction, was originally agreed to on the basis that there was insufficient water for all 6 units, but there is now, in fact, sufficient water for at least 3 units. So we're calling upon Eskom to integrate FGD into as many of the outstanding units' design and construction as possible to ensure that the flue gas cooler is used and to adopt a direct furnace limestone injection program to reduce SO2 emissions in the interim. And we say to the extent that Eskom is not prepared to do any of these measures, it should provide a detailed justification for its refusal to the department, to this committee, and to interested and affected parties. The MES postponement requirements are not being met. Just to reiterate those, postponement applications are only permitted to be made provided ambient air quality standards in the area are in compliance and will remain in compliance even if the postponement is granted. Number 2, applicants must be able to demonstrate that the facility's current and proposed air emissions are and will not cause any adverse impacts on the surrounding environment, and exemptions from the MES are illegal. Rolling postponements, so reapplying for postponements until eventual decommissioning, as is Eskom's plan for at least 2020 SO2 MES, apart from Medupi and Kusile, are equivalent to unlawful exemptions. Legally speaking, then, Eskom and Sasol should not be permitted to apply for postponements. All of their operations are in priority areas where national ambient air quality standards are out of compliance, primarily because of Eskom and Sasol's emissions. And there is a wealth of research and evidence that starkly demonstrates the enormous health impacts of these operations. We realize, of course, Chair, that granting postponements is also a political decision for which politicians should be held accountable. So we're pleased that this committee is taking a keen interest in these decisions and their outcomes. On offsets, we are, of course, aware of Eskom's significant financial and other multiple challenges. What's also clear is that in order to survive, Eskom is going to have to restructure itself significantly. Ideally, we say, it should transform itself to become the owner of significant renewable energy assets, promote clean, healthy, affordable energy for all South Africans. So we're excited to hear Mr. Govender say he's on the same page. It's also correct that compliance with new plant MES for SO2 is significantly more expensive than, for example, interventions towards better management of waste burning or cutting grass to manage fault fires, cleaner burning heating and or cooking devices or better insulated homes, which are some examples of the air quality offsets that Eskom and Sasol have proposed and which have been accepted as conditions of their postponements. These are all important measures that must be taken and should have been done many years ago. But the dire impacts of industrial emissions on human health cannot and will not be offset in this way. Air pollution from coal-fired power stations and large industrial plants travels hundreds of kilometers, affecting millions of people. It's not scientifically possible to cancel out industrial emissions through offsets. protecting human health is government's own constitutional responsibility. Good RDP homes and proper waste and fault fire management shouldn't be outsourced to corporates as an alternative to meeting the MEA. On the economic benefits of compliance, the EPA and the states has weighed those costs, the cost of compliance against the benefits of air emission standards for coal-fired power stations in its 2016 Mercury and Air Toxic Standards. The EPA found that the benefits of the standards are substantial. For every dollar spent to reduce toxic pollution from power plants, the American public would see up to $9 in health benefits. The EPA also emphasized that basing decisions on formal cost-benefit analysis is inconsistent with the purposes of the Clean Air Act because, quote, there are many societal values, such as protecting the most vulnerable, that could never be reduced to a monetary value. So far as ESCOM's plans with coal-fired power stations are concerned, and as we've previously indicated, we understand the reluctance to spend vast sums of money retrofitting stations that are going to be decommissioned in the near future. But since we're dealing with ongoing violations of constitutional rights, simply granting continuous postponement applications and allowing such toxic levels of pollution to continue to be emitted are in conflict with the state's constitutional obligations. Where ESCOM cannot comply with the MES, it must expedite the decommissioning of its stations, especially as it already has a surplus of generating capacity. ESCOM, however, has consistently maintained, and they also can't tell us today, no decision on the possible decommissioning of its coal-fired power stations has been made, and it has no decommissioning plans or funding for the EIAs required for decommissioning. In fact, it was investigating extending their lives. We're very relieved to hear ESCOM acknowledge today that this option is uneconomical, but we discovered just a few days ago from a 2017 socioeconomic study to which we were finally granted access by ESCOM that renewing the stations for another 50 years by demolishing and rebuilding them is also, or was at least, if no longer, under investigation. This is ESCOM's fleet, SRK's ESCOM Generation Fleet Renewal Project Socioeconomic Study of 2017. This study then evaluates options to refurbish, extending the life by 20 years, demolish and rebuild, extending the life by 50 years, or decommission four of ESCOM's oldest plants, Hendrina, Arnott, Kumasi, and Camden. The report concluded that refurbishment and demolition and rebuilding, if your version says decommissioning, please correct it, it's demolition and rebuilding, which both apparently assume the installation of FGD, were the preferred options, in that their implementation would lead to continuous maintenance of current employment, that is of 2,243 ESCOM employees, as well as creating new employment opportunities into the future. The report is seriously flawed. For example, it doesn't look at any cost analysis of any of the options, nor the climate change implications, and ignores the fact that ESCOM already has a significant surplus in capacity and that there's little or no demand for power from these stations. Of course, Chair, there are also not going to be significant future job opportunities in coal. In keeping with the global move away from coal, ESCOM should be actively planning together with its workers for a just transition to renewable energy, rather than risk stranding the workforce and redundant coal-fired power stations. We again draw your attention to the Meridian Economic Study, which found that without impacting security of supply, ESCOM should accelerate the decommissioning of Hendrina, Grootvlei, and Komati, and curtail the completion of Kusile Units 5 and 6, and this would save some $17 billion. These estimates don't even reflect the additional large savings on the impact of human health, local environment, and climate change that would result. Meridian points out that part of the savings realized could be used to cushion the impact on workers and communities and provide support for example, retraining, skills development, and relocation. So in conclusion, in addition to the specific suggestions we've made in relation to Medupi, we make the following urgent calls, which are also in addition to those we've already made in Broken Promises. ESCOM and Sasol should produce a plan for expedited closure of the coal-based plants. That includes Medupi and Kusile for ESCOM. ESCOM and Sasol should provide a complete list to us, to the DEA, and to this committee of all postponement applications they intend to make, for which stations and units, for which pollutants, for which periods, and by when. And they should provide full detail to us, the DEA, and this committee of all instances in which they do not foresee ever meeting the MES. Lastly, the DEA should provide a comprehensive response to the Broken Promises report. We know that you've heard most of this information from us before, and this is really what's most frustrating to us. The thing is, several times a year, we come to Parliament and to this committee, and we meet with the department, and we share these horrific figures about health impacts. But it seems that after a while, people stop being outraged. Maybe it's too unbelievable. Maybe it's too overwhelming. These are real people, real children, our fellow South Africans, who are suffering simply because companies like Eskom and Sasol tell us and tell government that it's too expensive for them to reduce their pollution, to comply with our lax standards, that it's not worth it. Even worse, they're making arguments here they would never get away with in other countries. But of course, South African lives are not less valuable than other lives. These polluters won't change until people like the members of this committee, like the National Air Quality Officer, like the Ministers of Environmental Health, Energy, Public Enterprises, Trade and Industry, and Finance say enough is enough. We can no longer morally defend sacrificing the lives of people on the Highveld and the Vaal in the interest of economic development. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next one.
Thank you, Honourable Chair and the committee. I'm going to try and be brief because I know it's late, but I think the point that I'm about to make fit in very well with the discussion up to now. I'm going to talk again about the question of the poor air quality in the priority areas, and I think you'll see the relevance of that. The second main point is that all ESCOM's coal power stations operate in the three priority areas, and they are all, and these power stations are major contributors to air pollutant emissions in these areas. Then I want to compare the South African, the DEA's MES, with those of other countries to put a perspective, because we are seeing that meeting the MES is a problem, particularly in with relation to SO2. Are we trying to achieve something that is too difficult? Are we trying to do better than anyone else in the world? I want to put that into perspective. Then focus on SO2, ESCOM's SO2 emissions, and the abatement options I won't speak about much because two presenters have already spoken about those. But finally, what can we do about this? The first point is one which is not made very frequently, and that is if you look at the three priority areas, they actually surround the densely populated areas of Gauteng, Pretoria, Johannesburg, or Tshwane, Ekurhuleni, and Johannesburg, an area with a population well in excess of 10 million people. They are not declared priority areas, even though the pollution levels in these areas are higher than in the priority areas right next door. They receive, in fact, the pollution from the priority areas. So the health impacts are not confined to priority areas. They include the 10 million plus people in these areas. The air pollution is bad, and this is the picture for the VAR triangle, PM2.5, 10-year trend. Two points. The one is the South African national air quality standard has exceeded the annual average just about everywhere, and it hasn't changed over 10 years. But the second is that if you look at the World Health Organization guideline, which is 10 micrograms per cubic meter, it's the exceedances are far greater than one would judge them compared with the South African standard. Now, ether 2, here we've heard ether 2 is not exceeded, and here's the annual averages. And compared with the national standard, yes, it's true, in none of these areas over this time period has the SO2 annual average been exceeded. But the problem is that the standard is extremely lax compared with the WHO. It's exceeded in some areas and only marginally compliant in other areas. The ISALT, same picture for the annual averages, but I want to go straight on to the daily average SO2 values in the HPA, Ermelo, Endrina, and so on, Secunda. And here you see the difference between the national standard and the WHO guideline, which is that green line right at the bottom, is far more stark. The national standard is for daily averages is 5 times higher than the WHO guideline. So what appears to be a generally compliant picture when you judge it against the national standard is far from a healthy situation. Because the air which is acceptable from a health point of view should have a concentration of way down below less than 7.4 parts per billion, the units are parts per billion in this case. So we are not the, with respect to SO2 levels in both the priority areas, we are not at healthy levels. We are far from it. We are far in excess of healthy levels. Now, the question of what is the contribution of the power stations and other industrial sources to the total emissions. Now, the first part was that's the situation as far as the air we breathe is concerned. Those are the concentrations. But what are the sources, and what's the relative magnitude of the different sources? Now, for SO2, I'll just focus on that because that's the main question being addressed by the committee today. Power generation is responsible for 82% of SO2 emissions, and household fuel burning, by contrast, is responsible for only 1% of SO2 emissions. So trying to address SO2 pollution levels by addressing household air pollution is ridiculous. The same situation, or very similar situation, in the Bar Triangle. In this case, industrial pollution has been grouped together with power station. And those two categories are responsible for 99.5% of SO2 emissions in the Vaal Triangle. And similarly, domestic fuel, less than 1%. So if we are going to address ambient SO2 levels, we can't do so by looking at offset programs and so on. You have to look at the source and address the source. And the largest sources, as we said, are the Eskom power stations and other industries such as Sasol. Now, just to perhaps repeat the point, but it should be common cause that if you look at the right-hand picture there, the MEA seeks to control emissions, and the National Air Quality Standards simply gives us a guide as to what a healthy level would be if you take into account the all sources of emissions. So the obvious point is, without significantly reducing pollutant emissions at source, you can't expect a significant improvement in ambient concentrations of the same pollutant. Now, the question of how do South Africa's MES stack up? How do they relate to those of other countries? And basically, they are extremely lax. If you look at the left-hand table in green, the right-hand table is you can look at that later. It's an excerpt out of an International Energy Agency fact sheet. And what I've done is taken those figures, and in the left-hand tables, I've shown you the ratio of the South African standard in relation relative to the other country standard. So for our existing plant MES is 17.5 times higher than China's existing plant MES, 17.5 times higher than Germany's, 6 times higher than India's, 5 times higher than Indonesia, Thailand twice as high. So that's the picture for our existing plant standards. And as you can see, four of those countries are of similar income levels as our own. When it comes to the new plant ratios, China 14 times higher, Germany 3, India 5 times higher, Indonesia was slightly better, Thailand about the same, the European Union 3 times higher. So we are not trying to achieve the best in the world by any means when we insist that you must at least meet the MES, both existing plant and new plant. So SO2 emissions. 1.76 million tons a year. I think Eskom showed the same figure earlier for the total annual power production from coal plants. The question which we've touched on in the committee indirectly over the last couple of hours is, what is the relative emissions from different power plants? In terms of SO2, which are dirtier in the sense that they emit more SO2 per unit of power. And there's quite a range, about a 2-to-1 range, from 6 tons per gigawatt hour produced to 11.4 tons per gigawatt hour produced. So if you look at the question of which ones should be addressed first, which ones should be used in production first, and you use this as a guide, you may come up with a very different picture compared to what is the cost of production of electricity from these different plants. Just to shorten this my presentation a bit, the bottom line is that, first of all, Medupi and Matimba plants, those two plants draw coal which are high in sulfur. Medupi has to do flue gas desulfurization. It's a contractual obligation. Matimba, on the other hand, should also do flue gas desulfurization. There is no other way in which it can achieve compliance with the MES, for that matter. It has to do something to comply with the existing plant MES, but certainly for the new plant MES. And the second guide we can take is that the most emission-intensive plants are, in addition to Matimba, Camden, Andrina, and Tutuka. So to meet the new plant MES, SO2 emission reductions of between 80 and 90% on all of the older Eskom coal power stations is required. Although dry sorbent or injection, it's less expensive and can be implemented much more quickly than flue gas desulfurization. It can only be seen as a short-term measure on the way to complying with and reducing emissions based on existing plant standards, existing plant MES, but in the long term, one or other version of flue gas desulfurization has to be done. I won't, as I said, dwell over the different methods for reducing SO2 emissions. They are well established and implemented worldwide. But how do we obtain cost estimates which are credible? We've seen some very high numbers as to what it will cost, and I don't know what credibility to put in those estimates, given the history of large cost and time overruns on Medupi and Kusile. How do we arrive at more realistic or credible cost estimates through competitive tender or an objective techno-economic study? And so my last point is the proposal to have a separate committee, I think, has to be approached very carefully. Because if, you know, exactly how, what will the remit of that committee be? What will the terms of reference be? The question of who's on the panel or who's on the committee is also important. What's a range of skills? And how will they weigh up the various considerations which they have to take into account? The chair has already mentioned that environmental issues must be high on the agenda. But there will be other costs will definitely come in. And then the more narrow problems which may be associated with individual plants may also come into consideration. So if we have a committee which comes and says, you know, it's either this or that or the other, but there's no clear way forward, we would have lost 6 months or more and still be back in the same position. That in order to get the pollution levels down, you must reduce emissions, and we must find a way of doing so. You have two ways. One is you have to shut down these plants, or you have to install efficient flue gas desulfurization systems. So that basically is my conclusion, and we look, the point is already made that ESCOM should be looking at renewable energy build program. The generation costs are lower than their coal power stations. The emissions are essentially zero, and it puts it in a position to look at a future which meets our climate change obligations. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. You said there will be two more presentations. Okay. You can from now. There's two benches there.
Thanks, Chair, for giving them an opportunity that come from Funabel Park and Middleburg, respectively. So.
Okay, don't be long, eh?
Yes. Thanks, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. I'll be very, very brief. My name is Samson Mukwena. I'm from a question called Vale Environmental Justice Alliance, based in Funabel Park. Lots have been said this morning and this afternoon, but our concern, and that was we've been saying to the National Quality Officers, that in the Valtra, you will need a proper air quality management plan. That is talking at the national level, at the provincial level, and at the local level. As we speak, Chair, we are very, very concerned that for the last 5 years, we have not had a proper air quality management plan. And whatever that has been happening now, it's been hijacked by the industry with an old AQMP to advance their own interest. So we say to the National Air Quality Officer that that's very, very urgent that a proper air quality management plan be put in place. Then the issue of technical committee that we're going to aspect, we are very, very concerned, Chair, because for the last 5 years we've been stuck in the source apportionment study, technical committee. We think that that work or that committee, as much as we claim to be independent, we are not sure how independent it is because it has industry influence, it has some institutional influence. And we know that there are very, very few independent scientists in the country in terms of exactly what the outcome should be like. Well, I can say that, Chair, the offset process...
You're referring to the new panel of experts.
What I'm saying, Chair, is that there is already a technical committee that do currently work on source apportionment study in the Valtrayan priority area. And the question that we are saying is that how independent they are, those scientists in that particular committee. For instance, the issue of CO2, it came into our attention in 2010. NACA will confess that. Where Sasol and Eskom, they were in conflict in terms of their source after their presentation on wind roses in terms of what exactly is the source of CO2 within the Valtrayan area. And then we agree in that process that there must be a source apportionment study to deal with the issue of CO2. So we are repeating the same process that is already taking place. We don't show in terms of what will be the outcome of this already committee that is already a committee that is doing certain work. And what we are saying with, tonight is that in terms of the Valtrayan area agreement is that parties must be abiding by the outcome, and there must be implementation of the outcome of the source apportionment study after they concluded the work. So we see this committee as another further delay of the work because we are stuck in the Valtrayan priority area because we don't have a quality management plan to work on. We are waiting the finalization of the report. So we see this as a duplication work. So it needs further clarity, as our colleagues have said, in terms of what will be the mandate of the committee. We are saying that on the issue of the offset, Chair, further there was no proper public participation in the issue in terms of how Sasol was taking up the issues in the offset. It was already predetermined process, and we've objected to that process. In fact, in November, we had a further discussion with Sasol management to say, is possibility that we can revisit the offset process that they are implementing in Zambia? For instance, Chair, they talk about 75 skips, trucks. There's the issue of land and recyclers, people that need to work on the recycling. They cannot give us in terms of the numbers of recyclers that are currently working on the offset. What is the issue of the land that are currently supposed to put infrastructure for local recyclers to work on that? There was a question earlier by the one honorable member around the air quality improvement. Dr. Eugene has done shown us the slide in terms of the Sasol Zambela station that the air quality there is increasing. And our further question was to say, what is the cause of the current increase of the air pollution within the Zambela station? And we cannot get answers in the platform that we are currently involved with. And we are saying, Chair, that a couple of issues that need to happen within the Valtrayan area, that there must be a release of the Valtrayan health study that was commissioned. And that study must be shared within the Valtrayan communities. We are saying that the low index energy strategy that was commissioned by the department, it needs to be revisited. I think the Department of Energy is here. Because we believe that it's only that strategy that talks to the low income energy household will address the issue of household air pollution. We are saying that the source apportionment study report must be fully shared with the communities within the Valtrayan so that our interventions actually are in line with the Valtrayan priority area. Last thing we say, Chair, there must be proper compliance and enforcement. We believe that to get better outcome, there is a need for DIA to make sure that the local air quality officers are fully capacitated and resources are deployed at the local level and provincial level to further make sure that there is a proper compliance. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Chair. Chair, I'm not going to dwell a lot on the issue of capacity, but I would just like to re-emphasize that right from the onset, when the air quality management plans were drafted, we indicated that local government has a lack of responsibility and we need to deal with that as a matter of urgency. And up until today, Chair, we haven't seen any form of improvement. And I would say, from a community perspective, we've even had enough effort to write to the different political heads of the municipalities to say we need to deal with air quality issues. We need to appoint staff, we need to allocate resources. In some instances, we've seen slight improvement, but that hasn't been enough. I had one other member asking about the monitoring stations. We have always raised this with DEA to say some of the monitoring stations within the project areas are not functioning. And it also raises a question to say, if those monitoring stations are not functioning, the little capacity we have at a municipal level will rely on those monitoring stations to get data, to take informed decisions about air quality issues in that area. So if they don't get qualitative information from those monitoring stations, how then should they take decisions? I think on a continuous basis, Chair, we keep talking about the different stakeholders that have to be part of the implementing task team, the multi-stakeholder reference group. I think we engaged with the Department of Health last year. We've tried engaging with the Department of Health in our own localities. We've insisted from DEA to say we need the Department of Mineral Resources to be on board, because some of the key problems with air quality come from the mining sector. And for over a year, we haven't seen significant changes with regard. And Chair, I'm sorry, I would like to be very personal on this one. I spent more than 5 years being unemployed, and I had to pay for my kid to go to the doctor because I used to live next to a mine. When all that blasting happened, when all that dust came from the mine, I knew how it affected my kid. And I had to be forced to relocate from that area so that I could seek an area at least which is much better than where I used to live. Now there are people here who cannot be relocated. They are stuck next to those mines. They are stuck next to these facilities. And we come here, instead of talking about their life, instead of talking about their health, industry comes here and tells us we need to consider cost of implementing abatement technology. They don't talk about the lives of the people. They talk about the cost of making profits in those facilities, not about protecting the constitutional rights of those people. So I think we need to set our priorities straight. Are we here to ensure that industry doesn't lose their profits, or are we here to ensure that the constitutional prerogative that we have as citizens in this country are fully protected? So if we are here about talking about ESCOM's and SASOL's profits, then I don't see why you are here, Chair. Chair, I think when we talk about offsets, last year I came here and I think Dr. Tully knows this. I think some of the ESCOM guys, you know, we had a session in Emalahleni, and I specifically went to the communities of Kwazamokuhle. I told them about the session. I said, would you guys please join us so that you could express your frustrations about the offsets? And I came into the colloquium and said, part of the problems was that the offsets are not sustainable. Instead of improving the lives of people, they're introducing another financial burden. We talk about LPG gas. The people of Kwazamokuhle say we do not have access to those LPG gas. The people, I mean, ESCOM and SASOL are supposed to come and tell us why do some of the people want their coal stocks back? Because basically the offsets are not working and they're not saying a word about those things. But I also requested that department must come here and tell us that they have an independent verification tool. How do they know if the offsets are working? Have they engaged with those communities? No, they haven't done so. All they're getting is the reports that come from SASOL and ESCOM without having their own tool to verify that. So I think that needs to be dealt with properly. I think I would slightly like to touch on the panel or the committee. I think what we need to be clear of is that 2005 we had the Act, and then we also started working on the MES. So when the MES process started, both SASOL and ESCOM were part of that process. We know from the onset that they were very reluctant to see the MES being promulgated. And we know that when they started applying for postponement, SASOL wanted to take the department for review because they don't want to comply. But if you look into the lifespan of these industries, it's almost more than 50 years that community people are facing the burden of health because of this, just these two industries. So now, we're saying today we need to go back, come up with a panel. We had an MES panel when the MES standards were established. There was a panel that was working on that. ESCOM and SASOL were part of that. They agreed to this, but when they have to implement, they're not implementing. Even the standards, their phases. It's 2005, then now we have to comply to 2015 standards, 2025 standards, 2020. They had enough time to transition, to make plans, but they're not. And all the time, it shows that stubbornly they're not prepared to comply to the current standards. Because they talk about rolling postponement. They don't say, no, we'll explore this, we'll do that. They are not prepared to comply at all costs. So I think this is the attitude we have to deal with here. Because if they were complying, I'm sure some of them would be saying, we'll be running out of business. But the stubbornness we have seen, and we have raised this last year, SASOL is prepared to invest billions in the U.S., but they're not prepared to invest a similar amount of money in South Africa. And most of their capital comes from this country. It's our taxes that they are misusing in the USA, and it's us who are paying the cost of the investment they are making in that area. The same goes with ESCOM. We've requested that they must come here and provide us with decommissioning dates for Arnold, Hendrina, Camden, because they're not efficient, and people are being affected. We go to ITT meetings, we see the SO2 spike in Hendrina, we ask, what's happening? Even DIA cannot tell us, because they don't have real-time data so that they could respond to all of these incidences when they happen. But then, when we come here, they say the process is negotiation. So it's the same system that was used by the APA, where instead of penalizing the polluter, we say, I don't want to take the polluter to court because he'll be my enemy. So we cannot allow that attitude. We've got regulations which we have to adhere to. So I think, just in closing, I think we need to be very careful about the panel. We've had panels before, they haven't worked. We've had expert advice coming from CER as to how we should contain our air. It hasn't been taken. We've had several researches, some of them done by groundwork with community people. We've engaged with these industries. Nothing has changed. So we need to be careful as to what exactly are we seeking to advise when we establish this panel. Are we going to ask them maybe to make us a list of abatement technologies that could be implemented by industries, or what? We need to be clear as to what's the role of the panel. Because what we're looking at is both ESCOM and SASOL telling us that we are not going to comply with SO2. So we need to take a firm decision. We've got laws in this country, and everyone should abide by those laws. Thanks, Chair.
Well, the chairperson is a bit out, but coming back now. Perhaps as the chairperson is coming back, what I may request the department has to do and not go to details, because we are still waiting, all of us, as to what will be the terms of reference and so on in terms of the panel. So for us to be ahead of that process and start engaging it now, I don't think it's correct. Well, it may be correct to raise concerns, to raise fears, whatever, or whatever views we think we have got. But to shoot it down like that, I'm not sure whether we are on the right path. Now, perhaps we may allow the department to just clarify that part once more, so that we are at one and not create an impression that we want to leave this meeting with some confused perspectives in terms of whether we need that panel or not. I thought we had concluded on it, to say the panel is required and it has a clear objective as to what needs to be achieved by it. And all we needed to do was to engage with that process once that is concluded. Whether it will be the same with what was done before or whatever, we can only know once we have got some outcome of that particular process. Thanks, DJ.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you to the colleagues that made the presentations. It's been interesting to hear the other side of what we do not do. In my view, the panel, which is what I was proposing, is going to focus on the technologies that are available to deal with SO2 in the nature of the operations that are existing. So, as you heard, I think, from the previous colloquium, the NGOs have got their scientists. We had academics that were presenting from a professor from the University of Fort Hare, and all scientists have their own views, and we have to get them in the room and also to give us a sense of what is available and what are the pros and cons. When I say pros and cons, there was, for example, in one of the proposals now about the flue gas cooler system. Already Water Affairs said no in those engagements previously with us, because as government, we work in some integrated fashion, even if it is not always effective. So we need to have Water Affairs experts as part of the process, because we can't solve one problem and create another problem. We are still a water-scarce country, and we then have to be sure that if we are then having technology solutions that are proposed, they are going to resolve a problem but not create another problem. And if there is going to be another problem that's created, what are the kinds of pros and cons of those limitations? So we need to have that common understanding, and it can be done by independent scientists. And each person will believe that your scientists are the best and the other one will have that. So you have to have the mixture of those scientists from industry, from government, as well as from the academic and the NGO sector, so that you have a basis for a sober engagement, and also look at what is available, do the cost-benefit analysis, and everybody has an opportunity to present their proposals in terms of what they know, because knowledge is something that must be shared. We may not necessarily know enough about what the NGOs say are the available technologies, but they may also, because they are not practitioners, not know that those have been tested in some instances and they have not worked. So that you then have that assemblance of engagement and create that platform. Because as a regulator, we regulate on the basis of all users, as well as also water resources being taken into account. Energy needs of those technologies must be also taken into account. And we are talking about old business operations here, which is something that, in the first place, I think the colleague from the NGO that was saying there was resistance from Sasol and even Eskom, even during the lawmaking process, to get to the point of regulations, because they understood that the APA problem, this is not a new problem. We had the atmospheric pollution regulations or legislation that was in place pre the 2004 Air Quality Act. And therefore, you can't resolve all of those problems without having some compromises. And that is what was enabled by the legislation, which is why you had the provision of
those postponements. It's not being irresponsible, but it's an appreciation that you are asking old plans to comply. There will be opportunities for them to really leapfrog, but there will also be some limitations, and we need to be able to be reasonable in terms of assessing those. So I have no view. That's why I'm saying proposing a panel that would actually look at those and have DST as part of, because they lead innovation in the country, and have CSIR as part of that, and a few other state agencies would help us a big, in a big way, and the Department of Treasury, exactly, that I thought we should also include, because they will look at the issue of cost-benefit analysis, but it should not be above what we want as an environmental solution. In the climate change response policy, Chair and honourable members, we undertook the same process. We had a whole technical study undertaken, not a panel that was looking at modelling different scenarios, which is why our mitigation scenarios are clearly understood by the key players and the bigger polluters, in that sense, still being Sasol and Eskom in the room, know what it looks like and how we arrived at those. So we should have enabled that process, because if we have conversations that are one way or two way, it is not going to help us. We need to have the multiple approach to dealing with this complex challenge. So that would be, in a nutshell, the kind of terms of reference. But I'm happy that we would first draft those terms of reference. If colleagues want to see them and input on them, we have no problems, and the process will be transparent. We'd have to advertise and make sure that we get the best. We are not going to have a big panel, but it will have to be a reasonable size, not more than 15 people at most, but normally even smaller if possible, because it has also got, it would have cost implications even for the department. So that's what I am saying. And if we don't do it, my assumption is that we are going to have this dialogue even in 6 months' time, and you will still not have other independent options. And when we have an independent option discussed, you have to have business in that conversation, because they must implement, and we need to know what are they able to, how they are able to implement, and what technologies, so that when we also prescribe this, because we don't prescribe what technology use, but we are looking at what that technology can do. If it is going to cause other problems, whether it's water demand, increased water demand, we then have to ask the question, water affairs, do you have enough water resources? Is it something that you want to explore? Or we then look at whether there is opportunity for that operation to rely on recycled water and all of the other possible good things. The next comment that I just thought I should respond to, Chair, if you still allow me to, is that, again, this issue of health impact studies, colleagues, I think it's irresponsible of us to come here and present to the public that if you've done an impact study that extrapolates statistics, which is not the actual exact statistics, it is going to be, because at some point these things you must test legally. So if you say those 2,000 deaths in that earlier presentation per annum in South Africa are linked to this operation, take Sasol and Eskom to court today and use that study and see whether you are going to be able to win in court. I doubt it, okay, because, again, you also qualified in the presentation earlier on that when mostly industrial emissions travel a long way, if the stack goes up, high up, how are you going to say it is the child that is sick in some other distance? It may be that somebody that's sick from who's not in the high felt but somewhere in Durban or I don't know where may have had some, received those, because the particles could travel a long distance. But you can't say when Chloe is sick, it is definitely directly from a pollution that comes out of Eskom or even Sasol. It's not easy. So we said to the committee, correctly so, because we are not here to present half-truths. We said we don't have the capability as a department to apportion those
pollutants to a particular company. We are not, we don't have that capability. If you have it, let's have a conversation and let's then take that science and use it and apply it. Otherwise, I think it's good that we create the necessary awareness that all of us want to achieve clean air, but the question is how do we achieve that without undermining all the other goals. But in the new plants, like you said, the Medupi, as well as, what's the other one, Kusile, there's no reason why Eskom does not meet, will not meet those new plant standards. But on old plants, I'm sorry, we will have to listen to them, because that is the situation. We have new legislation after they've built the plant. Those conditions were supposed to have been part of their license authorization when they were building the plant. When you design this house, your car, when we were phasing out, sulfur from diesel, low sulfur diesel, as well as your petrol, lead from petrol, you did not say throw away your old car. And we did not, all of us here, we need to talk about what it means in a simple sense. It means that you must throw away your old car and get the new car that is fitted with the equipment that can take the new specification. So those are the kinds of technical understandings that we must all converse about and say, here, Eskom, you are fooling us. Here, you are telling the truth. We understand your situation. Otherwise, we are going to create a hype about something that we will not have a solution for. And I'm not going to be able to promise the committee something that we cannot deliver on. Sorry. Thanks.
Any other comment from the department? Julie?
Thank you, Chair. I'll just make a quick intervention. The panel, the committee that Samson was referring to is for source apportionment. It's an existing study that we are doing in the Vile Triangle Pilot Area. After we have done a midterm review of the air quality management plan that was established by the minister, and it's actually operational and under implementation, and realize that industry have implemented over 70% of what they committed in the plan. But when we look at the ambient air, we are not seeing a similar kind of improvement, which would suggest, therefore, that our interventions are not targeting the problems where they are. Otherwise, we would have seen immediate 70% improvement in ambient air if those were the only sources. We agreed as a MSRG, which actually Samson is a member of the PSC of that panel, that let us do a source apportionment study so that we know what the main sources are and we address those sources. And it is a calendar year study. The summer, there's winter, there's the spring. Our emissions in South Africa are completely different in the different seasons. So we are frustrating it, but you can't have summer and winter. You will do the summer campaign in summer, and that is what we are working on. And as part of that equal management implementation, we had specific targets for building capacity in municipalities. And Chair, where we are now, municipalities in the private areas, at least we know they have the capacity that they need to perform the functions. We do have equality still a science. As skilled people resign from this municipality to the other or to wherever, and we still need to go back, but we do have capacity to address some of those issues. And maybe the last one, Chair, for me, that I would talk about is a monitoring network. We came to the committee at some point last year, and we had monitoring stations. We still do have monitoring stations that are operating and ASANA's accredited. The challenge was our system that was not able to communicate the data live to the public as we measure it in the station. We now have a system. It's here on the phone. You can check now live what the monitoring stations are measuring. So to say the municipalities don't have access to the data is a bit... I don't know what to call it, actually. So, but the other best is just to say we have the system. Yes, we acknowledge we are not 100% where we want to be. That's why we are committed and working on it. But we do have the system and we are part of it that are very, very successful. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. All right. I think those are the responses.
If you call, if you want responses from the department. I don't know, I saw a hand. I would like to move towards closing. It has been a very long day.
If you may allow, even if the department doesn't answer me, I'd be interested to know that when the department looks into the issue of non-compliance, especially in lieu of the atmospheric emission licenses with regards to specifically ESCOM and SASOL, where we see in the report that sometimes they get non-compliances, have they at any given point in time issued a clear directive, and then when that directive was not met, they started following the processes in terms of the law to say if they have to be taken to court, then let them be taken to court. If a license had to be withdrawn, let them withdraw a license. Because we've seen last year when we requested the number of cases that have been taken to court, not even a single one of the industries that were taken to court included ESCOM and SASOL.
In 2020, that's the time, because remember the postponement applications are 2020 and 2025. So right now the compliance officer can give us a report. There is a report available about administrative actions that have been taken in different areas. So Isham can provide that report if available.
All right, let's just get the questions and then the last round of responses.
When you look at the VAL HMP and NACACN, 70% of projects that were done within the VAL project was done by small and medium enterprises. Those were the key industries that were targeted because they are quite small in size and it's easy for them to be targeted. And we've argued that big industries in the VAL triangle, ESCOM, SASOL, AMSA did some work. Those big industries have not committed any in terms of look at their intervention strategies. The big majority, 70%, is the small and light industries. So the 70% is a true reflection to say the big industries implemented 70% of their projects. They were light and small industries. And we've engaged that within the VAL triangle priority area. The issue of health, DG, we are saying that we cannot, after year and year, commission studies. And those studies are not a recommendation be implemented and are hand left hand in the public. And communities at the grassroots level, those studies are not making their life change. For instance, the issue of low index energy strategy. We supported that strategy, particularly because it is to focus on the energy in the poor households. And we see the issue of offsets and so on and so forth, diverting what is government responsibility. So all of that, the issue of it is not a first issue. We actually chair in 2006 when SASO proposed a project called Basanje Gamakok as an intervention strategy to low income housing. We said this is not a sustainable project or strategies for people that live in sheds and RDP houses. 5 years down the line, SASO could not produce data in terms of how many in terms of reduction, what the project reduction was. So we say that instead of SASOL focusing on their own operations, Chair, they went to the AQMP, the work that was supposed to be done by local government, for instance, car testing vehicle emissions. CDBL, in fact, Mfuleni municipality, when you look at interventions, did implement that as a municipality. Because of the lack of capacity at Mahulu local government, it was SASOL came into play. And we've been saying year after year, since 2006, that the capacity must be focused at local level, where the local councillors, local officials are the ones who carry out the work, especially on compliance and enforcement check.
Any other point? Are you done? All right. Comments aside, I would like to give the department to comment on the issues raised. Prof, are you fine?
Okay.
Are you okay, madam?
I just want to
also in relation to the health impact assessments, I mean, Dr. Mike Holland carefully explained his methodology in the report, and he also presented it to Parliament. ESCOM itself has done health impact assessments. I'm also not a health scientist, but it's not really a question of whether ESCOM's emissions kill 2,000 people or 1,000 people. So we're not particularly concerned about winning that argument in court.
Well, okay. I won't comment on that one. It's a discussion.
Well, I don't understand the point. Oh, okay, yeah, I'll give it over. I'll hand over to you.
All right.
Let me just... the issue of the health impact that you made, what is the point, madam?
The question was that it's irresponsible of us to come and present health impacts because that can't be directly proven how many emissions.
Okay, I think the point was the data that was being used, I guess the DG was not agreeing with the data that you presented about the number of deaths and so forth. So I missed your submission. You say it was presented by Professor
Wu? I was just saying that the assessment that was used, the methodology to determine the attribution was explained in the report by Dr. Mike Holland, and he also presented it in Parliament, and that we're very happy to make it available again to the department. And I was also saying he's not the only person who's ever looked at the health impact assessments, that ESCOM itself has also looked at what the contribution of their emissions are to health. They've done their own report.
Okay. Are you fine, Prof?
I know it's late, but I have to comment on the committee. If the objective of the committee is to identify technologies for reducing, for abating SO2, it doesn't make sense to me. The SO2 abatement technologies are well established. We don't have to talk about South African conditions. Hundreds of these plants have been built around the world, in India, in China, and so on. Retrofitted as well, not built from new, but also fitted onto old existing plants. So it's not a technical problem knowing what to do and how to do it. And I can't see what the committee, both ESCOM and SASOL listed actually the common technologies for doing that. What's missing is you can go to each plant and say, well, what does it cost because this plant has got a certain size and what are the problems? That's missing. That has to be done. But a committee won't do that. That's serious work, and you'd have to get quotes from people and so on. Engineering work has to be done, and I can't see a committee being empowered to do that with the money available and so forth. So I really have a question as to exactly what this committee is going to do if the understanding is it is to identify various technologies and ways of reducing stack emissions of SO2. it's not just with the time involved, but, you know, what are they going to do which hasn't already been done and can't be, as I say, Cecil and ESCOM have already listed those technologies. What they haven't done is put the cost next to each one for each plant and so forth. So if the committee is going to try and do that, I can't see that happening from a practical... I mean, I'm speaking as an engineer now, not speaking for the committee.
Well, my understanding, and that's the same reason that we asked in the past that we need to get a proposal as to what will be the solution. Because my understanding is that it is not about the cost.
It's about what that technology is going to do. For instance, there's implications for excessive amount of water that could be used to abate that. The kind of technology you require will use a lot of water. For instance, there is an issue about other wastes that may be generated by using lime, for instance, that you will generate more waste when you utilize a particular technology. So the issue for me, as I understand, is not only about the cost. As I understand from today and from the previous discussion in the workshop and from also interaction with Sasol, for instance, who made that proposal, that it would have impact on, for instance, on waste. And therefore, the question that we are raising and which that panel must respond to is look at the various forms of technology that could be employed to address the problem, but also advise government, which is the Department of Environmental Affairs, on what needs to be done to address, because we cannot just accept that this problem is going to persist forever. We want this to be attended to. So this committee is going to be sort of an independent panel of experts that will include people like yourself, that will include other people, other experts, whose sole purpose will be to advise the minister on what must be done. If it means we have to review legislation because we cannot comply, it must advise. If it means that other forms of technology other than the ones that were presented by ESCOM and Sasol must be employed, they must advise that. So we're saying from where we are, it looks like there is no solution to this thing. That's why that panel has to be established with that sole intention. And of course, there will have to be engagement with other departments. Because if whatever technology that is going to be employed will use excessive amount of water, you will need an input from the Department of Water and Sanitation. So that's my understanding, Prof, of the mandate of this committee. And that's the reason why we are saying that we are supporting it. And we're even giving it time frame so that it can report as soon as possible so that we find a solution. It's better to engage with a solution that is presented by the experts than for us to sit around the room and to scratch our head, what is the solution? Because, you see, we're moving from different perspectives. We have got industry that is presenting to say, this problem cannot be resolved. We want that problem to be attended to, so hence we are supporting this. And that's my understanding of why this the proposal around this panel. Pardon? Oh, okay. From... Okay, no, it's fine. So I'm going to ask the DG to respond if there are issues to be... Well, there are issues to be responded to. And then... We will then adjourn.
Thanks, Chair. I think the other comments, that those last comments that were made, I think I agree with the colleague that was raising the issue of, for example, the use of or the interventions related to heating in households and transitioning those households from the way they are exposed to coal, or what do you call the indoor air pollution interventions, like the program on Basaji Makoko. I agree that that's government that should fund that, and hence I think initially it was coined by the Department of Minerals and Energy when they were still together as one department, and DIA was a kind of supporting that from an air quality point of view. So I do agree that maybe the formulation of the offsets need to be revisited so that the investments on the offsets must be meaningful in respect of reducing or limiting exposure to air pollution, than to sort out local government functions of providing certain services or government services, which in this case is funded through the offset program. So I think partly it's valuable to have insulation in houses and all of that. The question is whether government, if government doesn't have those resources, whether there is space to enable these entities to make a contribution in that sense. And that's the question that's being posed, and I think it's a matter that we need to actually revisit with local government, because these programs are discussed with local government, and they say these are their needs, and communities say these are their needs, and DIA is not actually the deciding authority in that sense. We first get those proposals and therefore endorse them. So that is something that we can look at reviewing. And the last one, I think on the health study, I think, Chair, we continue with the program on source apportionment study, which the department is engaged in, so that we are clear about what scientifically we can follow through, even when it comes to compliance licensed communities, whether it's ASOL or ESCOM, and even other bodies. So the study of my colleague can then make a contribution there, but I don't think on its own we'll be able to use it. That's what my comment when you were working outside. Thanks. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. All right, so we are done with this meeting today, very lively and robust engagements. So the way forward is, I think, what we have been repeating and repeating. We are going to have a follow-up discussion. We, you know, our responsibility as members of parliament is to listen to everybody else, and at the end of the day, and make sure that whatever policies that are decided, legislation that we pass, is been implemented. That's our responsibility. That's why we are following up on this minimum emission standard compliance. It is one area that we picked up, and I think, as you can hear from the discussion here, people are moving from extreme points of view. We've got the NGOs presenting very passionately about the impacts of oil pollution. We've got the department, we've got industry. So our duty is to listen to everybody and make sure that what the countries agreed on must be implemented at the end of the day. So that's what we are doing now. So I would like to thank everybody who has come here. The department, of course, we always meet with them. ESCOM, as we said, we are encouraged about the developments there. We hope that some of the things that were done in the past will stop, because the submission by the NGO about waste and some of the governance problems in ESCO has got a lot of merit. Part of the reasons why we had problems there was around governance issues and wastage. A lot of problems there. So those things must be sorted out so that there is sufficient resources made available for these compliance issues by Eskom, which is one of the most important utilities in the economy of our country. So I would like to thank you very much for coming, Sasol. As always, thank you very much. Our appeal is that listen to the pleas of the community and please try and address them wherever you can. For instance, I still don't understand why there is no meeting of minds on the issue of the offset, because that should be the most simple one. There's money allocated, consult with the community on the best possible approach, whichever technology you go for. So the community and the Sasol should all be at one if there is sufficient consultation on the ground. So I guess something that you must also look at, so that when you consult, you extend it as much as possible, so that you get enough inputs and so forth. But thank you for coming. Thank you, Prof. And I miss the name of Hugo. Okay, Mrs. Hugo. Thank you very much, and the gentlemen from the communities, you are welcome. Actually, today was not a workshop, it was an ordinary meeting of the portfolio committee. So ordinarily we don't relax that much the rules in the ordinary meeting, but I guess the committee secretary did not get the proper script, so. But it's fine, we do appreciate your input. And we'll continue to discuss these things, because air pollution is about the health of our nation, you know, especially in the areas that are declared the priority areas. So all of us have got an interest there. Okay, thank you very much. We are adjourned until next week. Tuesday. But she was talking about
Okay.
Okay, I'm going to
I think we can't do one today.
Tomorrow? What happened to me? Oh, yeah, what's your schedule?
Remember, come on.